Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast from the magazine of free minds and free markets, even during difficult moments. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy bank run, everyone.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
This is the most unhappy Monday, by the way. The Monday after daylight savings. Oh, it's grumpy Monday.
There's a lot of grumpy Mondays in my world, Catherine. So it's kind of, you know, get in line. We are, that's a preview of things to come, by the way. We're taping
this. What are you so upset about, Matt? Were you
I'm not here. I'm not doing.
Would win the Oscar or something?
I'm not doing gestalt therapy with you yet, Nick.
Gestalt.
That's our next iteration. We are, as I am looking at the clock here, taping this at 11:03 a.m. on a Monday morning. Let's check with our Dow Jones Industrial Average desk and see where are we at right now. It is, we're up 263.57 points, Nick Gillespie. That's 0.83%, all of which will be absolutely meaningless by the time anyone hears this. But it's important to be panicked or perhaps outraged or just snickering in the general direction of obnoxious tech bros in the wake of two bank failures. First, on Friday, the Silicon Valley Bank, the nation's 16th largest, was taken over by California regulators after experiencing a withdrawal run by panicky depositors, including a lot of technology-related companies who were all rightly worried that the bank's overexposure to U.S. treasuries, of all things, after the past months of rising interest rates, left it unable to cover its bets. Normally, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, will cover just the first $250,000 of any single depositor. After that, you're on your own. Sucka. But over the weekend, the FDIC and Federal Reserve announced that all depositors would be able to get all of their money due to a systemic risk exception. Great punk band name. As if to prove the systemicity, Catherine?
Yeah.
The announcement covered the deposits of a second financial institution, the Signature Bank of New York, which was closed Sunday by state regulators. The feds claimed that, quote, no losses associated with the resolution of Silicon Valley Bank will be borne by the taxpayer, end quote. President Joseph Robinette Biden II added, the solution also ensures that taxpayer dollars are not put at risk. Countered Elizabeth Nolan Brown in today's Reason Roundup, yes, it's a bailout, and yes, it's unwise. Damn, ENB. Catherine, I read in the Financial Times, so it must be true because of the pink paper, that, quote, SVB shows that there are few libertarians in a financial foxhole. Is the FT right? And or does Reason's seemingly hostility, that's language, just show that we're not clients of SVB and the Signature Bank?
I do like the pink paper, so I want to give them that, but they are otherwise misguided here. Of course there is such a thing as a principled libertarian, and this is just like absolutely absurd to suggest otherwise. It is true, however, that many people do abandon their principles when their bottom line is at stake. There is nothing special about libertarians in this regard. People are wishy-washy jerks all over the political spectrum. And some people who had previously said things about how markets should be left to function on their own are probably now saying, please bail us out. But there are, just as there are, in fact, many, many, many atheists in foxholes, there are also libertarians in bank runs. And it's utterly infuriating to imply otherwise, including, for instance, Reason's own journalists on this subject in pieces that have been published in the hours leading up to this podcast.
Peter, Catherine's Harvard boyfriend, Larry Summers, tweeted over the weekend that...
I thought you were talking about my literal husband who did go to Harvard.
Did he?
Wait, you are married to Larry Summers? I thought you were married to Dan.
I am married to Larry Summers.
I said boyfriend. Surprise. I didn't say husband. Oh, okay. Come on.
He's my boyfriend too, Matt. I love him.
Your husband was so good in The Social Network.
So Larry Summers said over the weekend that, quote, this is not the time for moral hazard lectures or for lesson administering. Dude writes like I do. Or for alarm.
It's the perfect time.
About the political consequences of bailouts. Did you hear my scare quote there? But now I'm talking now, not Larry Summers for once. But Peter, isn't it though? Shouldn't companies be cognizant of their of the $250,000 limit? And like when times of woe are happening, like say suddenly after a lot of years of zero interest rates, we're hiking up really fast. That's a time for those over 250,000 people to maybe like check to see if their bank isn't being totally ridiculous.
Yes, that's correct. And look, Justin Amash, not surprisingly, is correct here. A bailout creates a moral hazard, he tweeted, even if it's just a bailout of depositors at a bank. It doesn't fix, but instead exacerbates the systemic problem. And the public's always on the hook for the cost of any Fed program, no matter how much government insists costs won't be paid by taxpayers, right? So first of all, banks are taxpayers and they are paying. They will end up paying into the fund that is covering these losses. Second of all, banks are going to end up more regulated because of this, and that is going to raise costs for banking for normal people. But the whole point of that $250,000 limit is that there is supposed to be effectively a kind of a market, a crowdsourced risk risk measurement that is going on at all times, right? So people are supposed to say, hey, you know what? I'm protected up to a certain point. However, I'm not going to stick all of my money into a bank that might have a lot of risks because I know that then those risks are also mine. And what the Fed is basically saying here, what the FDIC is basically saying here, is actually those risks aren't yours. And there is never any reason for someone who is a depositor to worry, to think about, to concern themselves with the possible risks of the institution that they are banking with. What is that going to do? That is going to incentivize people to bank with banks that are doing risky stuff and that are making bad decisions. Because when you say that you're going to bail them out no matter what you're saying is your mistakes, your bad decisions, your risk-taking is not going to cost you, and it's not going to cost anyone else either. And so what they've done here is they've basically said, look, banks, you can make the exact same mistakes that Silicon Valley Bank has made over the past couple of years, and you can keep making them. And because we think you are systemically important, and we're going to use the word systemic, which has like a totemic power now in cultural and political debates, right? Just all across the spectrum here, whether it's systemic racism or, you know, systemically important banks, right? Because it's systemic, that means that we can step in. And the thing is that what they've done is they have made the banking system at minimum more prone to future bailouts and likely more prone to risky behavior in the future that is going to keep causing these problems.
Nick, you're almost as old as Hugh Grant, although with a much better skincare routine.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot less crinkly. I loved seeing him, just kind of cellophane out on the red carpet.
Fantastic.
And also seemed to have, I think his cheekiness was masking cognitive decline.
Oh,
you know, I think, but we can talk about that later, maybe.
I want to talk about that now, but okay. I will be.
He is a better actor than he has ever been, but I don't think he's all there anymore.
It's Paddington 2.
What does that say about acting, right?
Ask Ronald Reagan.
Stuff,
he had
man.
The role of a lifetime when he barely knew how to put his shoes on.
So we've been doing this, and by this I don't mean witty banter about Hugh Grant. Bank bailouts for about four decades now.
Yeah, yeah.
SNL crisis of the early 80s. We had the Mexican peso bailout.
That was the savings and loan, not Saturday Night
thank
Live.
Thank you.
Which, by the way, needs to also die. I think it's been bailed out enough. But
And SNL did have a crisis in the early 80s. That was some rough business Eddie Murphy came
around. Just ask Charles Rocket, right?
there's long-term capital management. Let's not forget that. Pour a 40 out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The bank bailouts of 2008, 2009, COVID-related.
No, those paid everything back. That's why everything is so good now, Matt.
That's right. COVID, obviously, the trillion-dollar fire hoses. How do you, Nick Gillespie, Hugh Grant of New York City, how do you think over time this has affected kind of the basic social contract of banking?
Oh, God, I don't know about that. But there's absolutely no question. Like, we fixed this, didn't we, with Dodd-Frank and with a million other interventions. So this could never happen again because nothing would ever be too big to fail or whatever. And we're talking about a bank that was like the 20th biggest bank in America. The fact that it's situated in Silicon Valley obviously plays a role in this. I do want to point out that the other bank that failed, Signature, has a Mr. Bernie Sanders on its board of advisors, which is, I don't know, that's a little bit creepy. But I was reading, the most interesting thing I read about this was actually written in 2019 by Sheila Bair, the former chair of the FDIC, who, when Hank Paulson and Timothy Geithner and Ben Bernanke talked about they came up with a plan for how to really bail things out in case, you know, it happened in 2019, because they had published a book or whatever, and she was like, you know what, you can't keep doing this. Like, that's a really bad idea. There are FDIC limits in that. The purists among us can take real, you know, bitter umbrage at all of that, that banks shouldn't be guaranteed, bank deposits shouldn't be guaranteed at all. But this is an absolutely outrageous flex by the government, you know, coming, you know, where in recent memory, we did this for the last time, for the one and only time. This is just, it's horrible. And it's a reminder, just as we've already forgotten many of the mistakes and lessons learned from COVID lockdowns and how foolish they were and how dumb policy was. We learned all these lessons, you know, a dozen years ago. And here we are now just doing the same thing over and over again in order to stabilize the economy, blah, blah, blah. As I think Peter said, you know, there's going to be a bunch of new bank regulations that come out of this that will make sure that this doesn't happen again for, you know, 5 or 10 years. But it should be extremely outraging to everybody.
So can I actually just say something here, since Nick brought up COVID? Because I think that that people are underrating the role that COVID policy played in the bank meltdown here, right? This is the compound effect of years of terrible policy, and not just previous bank bailouts. Because in some ways, what happened here was that during COVID, tech stocks and tech companies and startups just got absolutely flooded with cash, in part because people were staying home using technology, right? And so that's where they were. That's where people who had money to spend were spending their money on digital virtual stuff that they could access online, which meant that the tech startup world was just absolutely booming. Because the tech startup world was absolutely booming, they had a bunch of extra money and they needed to bank that money somewhere. So they put that money in Silicon Valley Bank. Well, now Silicon Valley Bank had a bunch of extra money. And what they did with that money was they invested it basically in government bonds that at the time were really quite low interest. And then what happened, of course, over the past year is that interest rates have started going up, in part because the Fed is trying to tamp down on the inflation that it was at least partially and arguably substantially caused by all of the money that the federal government spent during COVID to give everybody a lot of money so that they would be able to buy a lot of stuff online. And right. And so if you sort of rewind the clock several years and we hadn't done a year of, people call them lockdowns, let's just say business closures, and like a very, very strong cultural expectation that everybody stay the fuck home and not go anywhere and just like binge Netflix for a year. If we hadn't done that, then this probably wouldn't be happening. We would probably not be in this situation if we hadn't wildly overreacted first to COVID in terms of social expectations about what people are going to be allowed to do, and second, in terms of the fiscal response of spending about $6 trillion, depending on how you count it, over the course of about a year to give money to people directly, to give money to companies, right, to just inject a huge amount of money into the economy. And all of this is a compound result of years at this point of really, really terrible response
Catherine,
to the pandemic.
If we've been also just to build on that real quickly, the it's also, if you wind it back to 2008, in the beginning of 2008, George Bush did a stimulative tax cut to families with kids. Obama pushed that into new territory. There was also the TARP stuff. Like, we have been a bailout nation for a long time now. And I agree completely with what Peter was saying. And it also, it kicked, it broke the glass ceiling on the federal budget to a point. We're going to be talking about Biden's budget, I know, in a bit. But it's like, it's, we are spending unthinkable amounts of money, and it just keeps going up and up and up. And so these are all things like this. It really, I think it comes back to the, you know, the end of fiscal responsibility that really started with George W. Bush and his first couple of budgets. I mean, we need to remember that he basically increased federal spending by 50% in 8 years in real terms.
And that, and of course, goes like, beyond just war spending, which Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. About he increased domestic spending, by that much.
Catherine, we've already referenced Dodd-Frank a couple of times here. And as Nick was talking about how Dodd-Frank was going to prevent this from ever happening again, let's not forget that Sarbanes-Oxley was going to prevent this from never happening again, which was passed in the wake of Enron. Both were described in almost identical language by the presidents signing them under law as like containing this once and for all. Joe Biden, Catherine, not your boyfriend, this morning said as part of his reassuring remarks to the nation that some of the blame for what happened perhaps can fall on the shoulders of Donald Trump because he rolled back some of those Dodd-Frank regulations that were going to make sure that this never happened again. I remember kind of through the long COVID haze that at the right as the great financial crisis happened in September of 2008, I think I assigned you to like take a searing moral inventory of whether deregulation, as everyone was saying, I mean, everyone was saying, except
Glass
for like Matt
Stiegel.
Matt Kibbe was the only one not saying this at the time. Michael Flynn, God rest his soul. To take a look, like, hey, look, did we get there because of deregulation? Remind us of what you found in those pokings and what that might tell us or just like kind of frame us as we process similar claims this time around.
Yeah, I mean, they followed exactly the same template of blaming the most recent minor rollback of a regulation in the banking sector, which remains one of the most regulated sectors in our economy. Like the idea that, as and of course, Nick said in his nice old man voice, Glass-Steagall, which was at the time the thing that people talked a lot about. The partial repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999 was somehow to blame for the crisis in 2008. This is not the case. This is simply wrong. The political incentives are to look at the latest deregulation, if you like regulation, is to look at the latest little deregulation and say, it's probably that. The reason that I thought you were going to talk about my actual Harvard boyfriend slash husband when you were talking about Larry Summers is that I had a convenient in-house expert on venture capital, since that is the industry in which my husband now works, this weekend, who was... he was like a snowball of anger as the weekend went on. Because if you're a libertarian in VC right now, you're not a happy person. And you should know about him that he is generally less inclined, I would say, to profanity than I am. And so it's meaningful when he says, parents, cover your children's ears. We keep fucking bailing these fucking fuckers out. That's what he said. I could quote him on. He was very upset about it. As texts rolled in last night saying, whew, thank goodness, woo, everybody's safe. Wrong lesson learned, right? So his account of this is actually one in which you can at least tell a plausible story that it was regulations that contributed to this bank run specifically. And he pointed to a couple things that I just wanted to raise. One is... as Peter described, we had this situation where obviously, this is all in response to the raising of interest rates. Like, that's where the kind of initial movement comes from. The bank needed to raise capital. They did a sale. They had to do a second sale to balance the losses that were on the books from the first sale. Both of those sales arguably were, if not required by, at least kind of nudged by regulations about what your books can look like. Then they went into a quiet period. The SEC makes it illegal for you to explain what you were doing while you are doing stuff like this. You literally can't say to your depositors, to your investors, hey guys, you know, I could see how these two transactions might make you nervous, but let me just explain real quick what we're doing. I think you'll see that it's fine. That's illegal, which is why he did this weird don't panic thing and then was like, is it? Because like he really wasn't even probably supposed to say that. So there's at least one story here where like it's the SEC's fault. And of course, I love that story because the SEC is kind of always at fault. Silicon Valley Bank is not the bank that my husband's company uses, but it is the bank that many of the companies he invests in uses. And what he said is like a lot of those companies have failed. And as an equity investor, failures are expected. But as a debt investor, which is what the bank is, that many failures are bad. That's like that's not how it should work. So there's clearly something going on with the bank itself as well. I don't want to say, you know, but for the evil SEC, everything would be fine. But I think the very, very idea that people will raise that somehow deregulation is to blame for this is bananas, because these banks are hemmed in by more regulations than you and I can possibly imagine.
On the contrary, I think deregulations are to blame.
Nick, let's ignore that ever happened put a button on this one.
I need to take a knee, Matt.
In all of the contractions that have happened in the freakouts and non-freakouts and the bailouts and the non-bailouts, I can think of one in the last like 25 years that didn't happen. The government did nothing. And that was the dot-com collapse of spring of 2001. It was kind of glorious. Everyone lost their job, or a lot of people lost their job. I lost all those like rich freelance stuff for like industry standard furniture.com type of magazines that were paying $1 a word. It was awesome.
And it was Canadian dollars too. So it was like worth $1.25 back then.
It was amazing. And nothing happened. How disappointed are you that the obvious animus that people have today, towards especially the super out there, extremely online Silicon Valley tech bros who are like, you have to bail us out. And it's not at all, contradictory to everything that I said last week about everything else. We can't even convert that mutual animus to 90% of America does not like those people. And yet here we are.
I think that's a really fascinating political economy question, because the tech sector didn't get bailed out during the tech bubble. Although Sarbanes-Oxley, also, you know, while it had to do with Enron and a couple of other things, it also kind of had to do with the tech bubble bursting on some level. The idea that the economy was made of twigs and was, you know, it was all just kind of smoke and mirrors. I almost, you know, to be a little bit conspiratorial, maybe this is a gesture on the part of the Democratic Party that felt like it might be losing Silicon Valley or whatnot. This is a gift to them to say, hey, you know what, we're going to take care of you. And we'll expect at some point in the near future that you help take care of us. But it's stunning because this, you know, tech is more hated now than it has ever been. And Silicon Valley, you know, has become a vampire on the American economy and the public imagination. And for them especially to be receiving this, I hope that somebody smart and not somebody like Donald Trump really makes hay out of this. Because, you know, the one thing that was good about the financial crisis is when people started to say, you know, that businesses get to keep their gains, but they socialize their losses, like big business, politically connected industries, et cetera. That was absolutely true when we were talking about the financial crisis. And we should start talking about that again, because that is a terrible way to run an economy where, you know, the rich people have enough clout so that they never really lose. It's just bad.
It does feel like our heads are just going to be crushed between the sides of the political horseshoe forever now. Like the idea that it's like there must be a big chunk of the left that's mad about this. I remember Occupy Wall Street. I know those guys are still around. Like Bernie exists.
Bernie is on the board of a bank that just got guaranteed too. So,
And so there's this gap between the rhetoric and the reality. There's this gap between the principles and the execution. And again, screw everybody who's out here being like, you know, the real hypocrites, libertarians. No. Screw you guys.
Let's shift. We've already previewed it a little bit that lost somewhere in all this hubbub was that President Biden unveiled a $6.9 trillion with a tara dollar budget proposal.
Has he done a tetrillion yet? Like a terabyte or something? A tetrabyte?
It is true. It's always worth reminding people that it is the Congress that is constitutionally tasked with writing and passing the budget and not the chief executive. But what we've seen in the last 10 plus years is that as often as not, it's the president and the leaders in Congress who sit down at the very last minute and hash out their competing visions in a must-pass cromnibus on December 17th. So that's makes this worth looking at a little bit more closely, perhaps, than usual. And also, there is the constant Democratic refrain that budgets are actually statements of our values. So, Peter, what values is Joe Biden expressing with his proposed budget?
Well, I think one value he's expressing is that he believes in fiscal nonsense. And so I would point
malarkey.
That's right. He's a big malarkey proponent. It's important to him. And so he has enshrined malarkey into $6 trillion worth of it. I think the thing I want to talk about here is his Medicare solvency plan, which is notable for how much malarkey is involved. And so what Biden has done is he has taken a tax that was part of the Affordable Care Act, net investment income tax, which is sort of part of the HI payroll tax, right? And so Obamacare created a 3.8% tax that was just sort of on investment, rich people, et cetera, right? The idea was, oh, this is just, we're going to tax the rich to pay for this. And that tax money just went to kind of the general fund, right? Like it wasn't dedicated to pay for the Medicare trust fund. But what Biden has done is redirect that money so that it specifically goes into the Medicare trust fund, the hospital insurance fund that is set to be insolvent by the end of this decade. Now, let's take so what he's done is take a tax revenue stream that we already had and just said, well, now we're going to pretend that it goes directly into the trust fund. That's not raising any new money. That's just redirecting money. It doesn't actually make the trust fund any more solvent in any real sense. It just sort of says, well, now there's a dedicated funding stream outside of the trust fund itself. And remember, the trust fund was supposed to be self-sustaining, like when it was created all those years ago, right? So it is an admission that the trust fund, which of course is an accounting fiction to begin with, that the trust fund is just like can't sustain itself and requires some sort of outside funding. So they've done that, and then they've also raised it. Because, of course, when you create a new tax, as they did under Obamacare, that creates opportunities to take that tax and ratchet it up and turn that dial, right? So that you're getting more money out of it. You're taxing people even harder. And so this is in some ways a preview of the Democratic vision for the entitlement state, for Medicare in particular, but for just for old age entitlements generally, because right now they're not sustainable. And what it says is basically, we're going to have to do a bunch of accounting tricks that just create fake money and make things look better on paper. And then also we're going to have to raise taxes a whole bunch. And that's the only way that we're going to be able to make this sustainable at all. And even then, we're still a couple of decades out from yet again running into insolvency.
Nick, sorry.
It's malarkey, and it's it's partially it's a fantasy, but it's also revealing about the Democratic vision for this sort of thing, because, you know, even if it's not going to happen, it's a sense of like this is what it would take for
Nick,
it to happen.
Let's presume a fictitious non-malarchical world for a second. What would be wrong with making the old age entitlement formula more solvent by lifting the cap on payroll taxes and such and increasing taxes on the rich?
I wanted to just put in a word for plant-based malarkey. I think we need impossible malarkey or beyond malarkey. I would rather have that shoved down my throat than what we're getting right now.
Now, as to the question that I asked you.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that these systems, my basic critique, and I believe in a social welfare state that helps people who need it, merely continuing to tax unsustainable entitlements that are universal, it increases the size, scope, and spending of government. You know, we're coming up on 70% of the federal budget is going to be, you know, kind of mandatory spending, most of that between Social Security and Medicare. It's bad. If you are wealthy enough, you should pay for your own retirement and you should pay for your own health care. And merely extending a system which ends up helping relatively wealthy people, you know, live a lifestyle that they have, you know, is just wrong. It takes money. It robs money from relatively young people and gives it and poor people and gives it to relatively old and relatively wealthy people.
Catherine, I hear, though, that at least the Biden budgets reduce deficits and the debt. So that's good, right?
God, the lies, Matt. It's just more lies. I used to fight with you about whether it was a good idea to accuse politicians of lying when maybe they were just like using different standards or operating from different principles. But this is just a lie. So Biden's budget would shrink the primary deficit, which is the shortfall of government revenue to cover government expenses. But that ignores interest payments. You know who else ignored interest rates? Anyway,
very interesting.
The future projections about what percent of the federal budget would be consumed by net interest. It's the scariest graph you will see. And I guarantee you that they will not be putting this on the White House Instagram account with their stupid lying, stupid graphs. By 2033, it's going to be 65% of the budget interest rates, just paying interest. The primary government spending as a percentage of the federal deficit is going to be 35%. It's so little compared with what we're dealing with in terms of interest rates. And Biden is just pretending they're not there. And so therefore, he cut the deficit. That's not how money works.
All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, do you really know yourself? Are you the same person that you were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or maybe 9 days ago when you didn't have COVID, you weren't preparing your taxes, and your house wasn't infested with lice? If your being has indeed changed with the circumstances, have you also adjusted your self-conception and your way of operating in the world? Therapy with a trained independent arbiter can be a worthwhile way of deepening your self-awareness, rejiggering your interior operating system, and coping better with what the world throws at your face. That's where BetterHelp online therapy comes in. BetterHelp is easy to use, super flexible, entirely online. Just fill out a quick questionnaire and start increasing your self-knowledge right away. You can discover your potential with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder to email us your readably short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Chris from down the street from our DC office. That doesn't sound creepy at all. Chris writes in part, I read your website every day. Thank you, Chris. And the Reason Roundtable is a regular fixture in my life. Thank you, Chris. I also enjoy the Reason interview. Thank you, Chris. And hope to one day go to New York to watch the Soho Forum in person. More TK. I run small businesses and we are regularly affected by anti-free market decisions by our city local government. Most of the people I know celebrate these for equity or fairness or whatever reasons. Despite these regulations actively hurting our businesses and most of all our employees. My question is, what book would you recommend for my statist, establishment-friendly friends, colleagues to maybe get them thinking about free market principles, Catherine?
I recommend very, very short books. People aren't going to read long books, maybe even just stories. I know that there has been a lot of discussion about whether, in fact, how many layers of irony are on this short story, but I still recommend Kurt Vonnegut's Harrison Bergeron, which is a very good, simple, understandable lesson about maybe why equity isn't all it's cracked up to be. Also, maybe some Bastiat, but honestly, I would start with Harrison Bergeron.
Nick Gillespie.
I'm going to go with a sacred text map that Dr. Zayas finds at the end of Planet of the Apes called The Declaration of Independence. How libertarian politics can fix what's wrong with America.
Really? Now, you would think this man who lives down the street from us should give people a copy of the Declaration?
Because
when they're like, hey, I think the signage regulations are good.
And the reason for that is because I've had a bunch of people, and by that I mean I think three people who are not libertarian, stumble across it in the recent past, meaning about the past month, and they all said, you know what, this was really fun, delightful, and it made me rethink a lot of things. So,
what part of the ayahuasca experience was that?
That was all of it, Matt. And, it's more of an Ibogaine trip. You know, it's much more intense. Ayahuasca only lasts for, 1,000 years. This is like 10,000 years.
Peter, besides seconding that recommendation, what would you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, Catherine is obviously correct here that it should be Harrison Bergeron. But let me take this in a slightly different direction. On the one hand, I recognize that this is a bad idea. And on the other hand, I kind of think that he should try giving his friends Atlas Shrugged.
What is wrong with you?
And I get
he's,
that it's long.
Yeah.
And I get that Ayn Rand has a reputation.
Yeah.
And that people like have a natural reaction when they see the words Atlas Shrugged and Ayn Rand and that cover with the guy holding up the world and the whole thing. And so maybe the way to do this rip off the cover and the cover page, but also maybe the back half of the book. Like just like the first 150 pages or so.
The ghost of Ayn Rand is going to murder you in your sleep
suggestion. It is not in keeping with Rand's wishes. But what that book does, we could have a whole hour just on that book. But what that book does at its best is it just reinforces over and over and over again that authorities, public authorities in particular, who are operating in many, though not all, cases with genuinely good intentions, set up rules and regulations that end up having unintended negative consequences, in particular on businesses, and those rules end up backfiring. They end up hurting the people that they are designed to help. And so, in some ways, Harrison Bergeron, Kurt Vonnegut makes that point in a funnier and much quicker manner. But Atlas Shrugged is actually really good at just reinforcing that point and just saying, look, these people are going to make these rules. And of course, some of them are actually kind of bad people. But a lot of the people who are agitating for the rules, they're good. They would like to see them put in place for good reasons because they're decent people and they feel like this is how to be a good person. And yet, when you put those rules in place, inevitably, there will be unintended but often predictable consequences that will backfire and hurt the people that they are
supposed
to. All right,
I'm going to actually attempt an answer to the question, damn it. And that is to, for those of your people that actually read books, pursuant to Catherine's...
Pitching and wooing, Matt?
Not just
the
yet.
The Bob Belinsky story?
Not just yet, although that is a classic. That'll scare you straight from... so many different things. The Future and Its Enemies by Virginia Postrel, her great late 90s book that talks about dynamism and statism.
No, stasisism.
Stasisism. It's too hard to pronounce that.
Stasis.
Systemic stasis. Yes,
stasisicity. And it gives, especially for people who are going to be allergic to the word libertarian, which is not overemphasized in the book, gives a basic, this is how things work, and teaches you about economics along the way, which is the point of your query. If these people don't read, which is likely, they can also see the history or beautiful tales of unintended consequences at Reason TV. By the glorious Austin Bragg et al. That will also teach you what Peter just talked about. And if you really can't read and are on Twitter all the time, follow the Human Progress account from Cato Institute, which just tells you like, hey, look, this good thing happened and it keeps happening where there's capitalism. And then people might click on a link and follow it from there. And good luck and Godspeed. Don't creep out Peter and Catherine in the booth from.
No, come say hi. We like it when people come to the office on Friday at like 4:45 so that we can stop working late. And have a beer.
Things have changed around there.
you know, Matt, I read a tight ship.
Now you admit that people lie. Okay, lightning round. On Thursday, the Republican-run House Judiciary Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. That's really what it's called. Invited journalists Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger to testify about their work on the ongoing Twitter files investigations. So called after new owner Elon Musk opened up some of his archives for various journalists to peruse. The company's cozy relationship with censorious types in and around government, particularly as concerns content related to COVID, January 6th riots, Hunter Biden's laptop, and alleged Russian disinformation. Taibbi, who has long been understood as considerably left of center, and Schellenberger, who's kind of a centrist Democrat type, I don't know how he calls himself these days, but that's how it used to be, were subject to just amazing contempt by Democratic lawmakers. It is fantastic. Click the links on all of those people. Yeah. They were described variously as so-called journalists, as in one case, actively dangerous. They're good. They're dangerous. That's right. I'm dangerous. And as profiteering in an unseemly way from their Twitter files work, Taibbi wrote a piece about it that I recommend called "The Democrats Have Lost the Plot." Catherine, quickly, can you ruminate how the Democrats have indeed lost the plot?
Yeah, looking at Matt Taibbi's face during that whole episode, like I've never identified more with a person on C-SPAN than in that moment. Like, so many of the questions, you could just see him. And he wrote about this in his newsletter. Like, he describes his experience there of largely of being one of him not being sure if they had really asked the question that was as stupid as the question they seemed to have asked was. And then having it slowly dawn on him that, yes, the stupid question was the one they had asked. And then trying to figure out how to not say, you know, to an elected representative of the people of the United States, wow, that question is so stupid as to be unanswerable, over and over and over. And that, for the most part, was what was going on, as far as I could tell. This hearing shouldn't have existed in the first place. And I think the conduct during that hearing made that point better than
I think that hearing is perfectly legitimate. My God, yeah. Talking about the government leaning on a social media company to censor individual voices. I want to hear about that. Catherine?
I think
this was not going to be
a congressional hearing.
I think what it illuminated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we agree that.
I think what it illuminated is how unfucking believably dumb Congress is. I mean, really, it should be mandatory viewing. You know, if school kids had to watch the space shuttle blow up, they should be watching this. It is just so,
you know, I watched that as a school kid in real time, Nick.
Yeah, maybe it didn't work because you still like NASA, right? Yeah, but it's like
pro-rocket.
What I loved about this too is it took that, you know, during the like the Facebook hearings and the earlier in 2018, the social media things where, you know, Pat Leahy and Dianne Feinstein were shaking their jitterbug phones at Mark Zuckerberg or whatever. And like, can you help me? you know, make stop making it, you know, make these weird noises or something like that. This, the people who were asking the questions were significantly younger and possibly significantly dumber. It was fantastic. And I say this to somebody, I worry about the decline in confidence and trust in government. And this one, man, this is the equivalent of the SVB bankrupt. Like, nobody should be believing in government after watching even 5 minutes of that. And my favorite bit, which is widely circulated, was when a congresswoman suggested that Matt Taibbi, Michael Schellenberger, and Barry Weiss were in a threesome.
Yeah.
You know, or like, are you part of a threesome? And like, and it's just clear, like, there are just like squirrels in the heads of Congress people running around. They're like, they make Homer Simpson look like Albert Einstein.
Peter, what was your reaction watching this?
I mean, I'm with Nick. The best reason to oppose government oversight of social media and other media is listening to members of Congress talk about social media.
And other media.
All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Nick, let's go to you first.
All right, thank you. And I am, I watched, partly because it was nominated for an Oscar for short documentary, it did not win, but The Martha Mitchell Effect, which is available on Netflix, came out last year. And it's by Ann Alvarg. The director, Ann Alvarg. And it is a fantastic look at one of the most interesting but kind of forgotten in time now aspects of the Watergate conspiracy and whatnot, where Martha Mitchell was married to John Mitchell, the absolutely scumbag attorney general of Richard Nixon. And she noticed when she was watching a TV account of the break into the Watergate that she knew one of the burglars, and that she wouldn't shut up about it. She thought she was protecting her husband from a cover-up that was going to, you know, kind of take him down, not realizing that he was, you know, neck deep in doing the cover-up and things like that. And she was gaslit by the Nixon White House, who started saying she was a drunk, she was held, you know, a captive by the government, et cetera. And it gave rise to a psychological term, the Martha Mitchell effect, that was coined in the late 80s by a psychologist who said this is what happens when people talk publicly of things that seem to make them, mark them as delusional, but they end up being right. I highly recommend watching The Martha Mitchell Effect. It's a brilliant kind of window onto a very fucked up and dark chapter in American history, in the way the presidency and the government use the media to certain types of effect and ultimately failed. Martha Mitchell, I should also add, if you're my age, and Matt, I suspect maybe you remember her too, she was this ghostly figure in, you know, in my early childhood of like, of an insane woman, like a housewife who yapped too much. That was her big problem. She was lippy and mouthy and insane, and it turned out she was absolutely right. It's a fantastic anti-government piece as well as a feminist piece in the best way possible. The Martha Mitchell Effect.
Very, very Sazian also.
Catherine, what did you consume?
First, I need to issue a correction from a previous what I'm consuming. Helpful alert listener Wade, who has been a home brewer and a Reason subscriber for 3 decades, writes in to say that while I am correct that the Belgian beer that I recommended does use sugar, which makes it somewhat distinctive, the thing that really matters is the unique phenolic character of the Belgian yeast. My apologies to those who are hanging on my beer analysis. It is not the sugar.
What is the yeast?
It's still
what's
a very
that term
good...
you use? What was the adjective of the yeast?
Phenolic, phenolic. I don't know enough, but Wade knows. Thank you, Wade, for straightening me out. My recommendation is the podcast Dear Hank and John. It is the Green Brothers, and I continue to recommend their work despite being told that they are cringe. I don't care. I have recommended on this podcast in the past John Green's Anthropocene Reviewed, both the pod and the book, in which he rates human stuff on a 5-star scale. It's out on paperback, I think, this week. But Dear Hank and John is these two brothers, these two brothers who are like just YouTubers from way back. And they do reader questions, and then they give the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, which seems to be a soccer team. And they kind of live in the space between like science and existentialism, which is a space that I enjoy. So it's stuff like, can fish see water? And what is the difference between an ology and an onomy? And how do I be brave in the dark? And stuff like that. I will also recommend this podcast, despite the fact that there are regular asides in it about how billionaires are the dumbest, worstest, and that they are a sign that things are wrong with our society. These guys are not libertarians. And you know what? They still make good stuff. So it's fine. You can enjoy things that don't have your politics. Dear Hank and John, a podcast if you like, as I suspect you do since you made it to the end of this one, podcasts where a couple few people chat about weird stuff.
Peter, what kind of weird stuff did you consume last night?
I watched the 95th Academy Awards. So I have complicated feelings about the Oscars because I love movies, but I don't care that much about the awards and the celebrities and all the rest of that. I often find the ceremony kind of annoying and exasperating or just plain boring sometimes. And even when I think the Academy is awarding good movies, as they did last night with Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is a great movie and came away the big winner, it also often just sort of comes across as self-serving and not quite random, but pretty close, given the selections over the years. But because I love movies and because I think movies are important, I will also admit that sometimes these ceremonies can get to me. And there are moments that really that stand out and that, you know, I almost want to say they matter. And in particular, last night, the Best Supporting Actor Award went to the former child actor and immigrant, Kei Hoi Kwan. So you may remember him as Short Round from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. He was also in The Goonies, worked a little bit after that, and then basically took 20-something years off from acting, worked a little bit behind the scenes, did some fight coordination, that sort of thing, and then came back and was in Everything Everywhere All at Once, for which he won an Oscar. And so this is a guy who fled the communists in Vietnam. He, right, like, he just sort of tried to get out, right, and came to America, and he is so proud to be an American, right? And just like crying up there and saying, look, this is the American dream. Honestly, a great moment. A great movie, a great moment, a great performance. Totally deserved. It was the, I believe it was the very first award they handed out, and it was the highest.
He was robbed. He should have got one for being Short Round. Let's just be honest about that. It's fantastic. Sure. Someone on Twitter last night was like, what we really need is him acting in a follow-up to Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom, where he tries to return all the treasures that Indiana Jones stole back to their rightful owners, which is a good call back to the Holy Land exhibition recommendation that I made last time. And speaking
of... Are we doing callbacks to Matt? Previous recommendations now?
Indeed. Speaking of my fondness for small Southern California-based museums that I visited in February, Catherine's comment about Columbia blowing up reminded me of all kinds of fun memories. And one of them is that I visited a place I didn't know that it existed until I was like, hey, where can I take my dad away from the old folks home that isn't that far? And it is the Columbia Memorial Space Center in Downey, California. It is a great tiny little museum, just like two floors, pretty small, containable, set up for kids. So you can do a thing or figure out like how to, like you hitch up a space pod, an Apollo thing onto different types of parachutes, see which one you can steer to land on the floor in the right place, goes up a floor. That's really cool. You can make a paper airplane and try to make it the most aerodynamic and put it in a little thing and go, and then and see how far you get through the thing. That's great. And there's...
I'm sorry. So are there a lot of activities where you crash a spacecraft?
It's pretty fun.
It is NASA.
Wow.
Listen, Catherine, we've put too high a price on lives. No, it's there's also memorials about the astronauts who perished that are, it's very well done, and Apollo stuff. But it's just a great little museum for kids. It's on the site where there used to be North American, which was then replaced by or changed its name to Rockwell International, where my father worked for 15 years. Didn't work at that site for the most part. Worked in Seal Beach, not that anyone cares. But it's great. And I just a shout out to the people who run it. When they saw that there was an old aerospace engineer coming through, they made a beeline and, like, you know, thanked him for his service. And they have a regular sort of meetup of the old timers who sit around and tell just terrible lies about their security clearances and whatever. It's a really sweet, tiny little museum in Downey, California. And it'll teach you about shuttles. And it's, again, good for kids. Check it out. Columbia Memorial Space Center. And there's a big shopping mall across the street, and a lot of restaurant options. Just want to make sure that people are aware of that. That's all the awareness.
Early bird specials.
There are Chili's.
It was taken, Nick. You damn right. That is all the time that we...
An In-N-Out? A Waffle House?
I think an In-N-Out, not a Waffle House. We don't really do that in California. Not enough hurricanes to make that.
Does is your dad at a stage now where he's willing to spring for the sour cream on the baked potato, Matt? He's like, you know, don't hold back.
Yeah, he's lost F's to give. That is for damn sure. So that's all the time we have. Thank you for listening. If you like what we do, go to reason.com/podcasts. Nick, do you have anything to announce about future New York events?
Yeah, on Monday, April 3rd, there'll be a Reason Speakeasy at the Blue Building on 46th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue, where I'll be interviewing the authors of The Individualists, an intellectual history of the modern libertarian movement and what the future looks like. That's John Tomasi of Heterodox Academy and Matt Zwolinski, a philosopher at the University of San Diego. It's a fantastic book. It's a fantastic venue, and we always have fantastic crowds. That's Monday, April 3rd. Go to reason.com/events, and you'll find a link to tickets and all that kind of stuff.
Speaking of events, just get yourself preliminarily excited. We're going to do a live roundtable in an evening setting in or around New York City, possibly at the end of next month. More details, TK, as they say in the journalistic biz, but it's going to be very exciting, and we hope to see you in person. And, maybe Peter will teach us how to make cocktails or something during the event. So stay tuned for all of that. If you like what we do as an organization, and I hope you do, if you listen this far, please go to reason.com/donate and see how you can support us in our endeavors. Get it? All right. Thank you. Goodbye, and have a pleasant tomorrow.